1370. Please donate online at kpft.org.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
On KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston, 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville, 89.7 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. First, I kind of hope you're sitting down while you listen to this, because there is a runoff election on June 15th. Yes, there is. I'm sorry. But first, I recommend going to offthecuff.com to read the article titled, A Couple of Follow-Ups on the Runoffs, meaning our most recent runoffs, not our next runoffs, although that's included too. I'm linking to his article on the show post, but you can go directly to his website. Cuff provides some happy results and also reports that the June 15th runoffs will be for the HCAD positions. I'm pasting in election information directly from harrisvotes.com. Early voting starts Monday, June 3rd, so basically next week. Voting centers will be open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Election Day. There'll be more information, I guess, next week. I'll discuss it more. But early voting, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Through Tuesday, June 11th. I have a link to what's on my ballot for Harris County. Obviously, if you have to go to a different county's clerk, then do that. Deadline for a mail ballot is June 4th, so we're really kind of bumping up against some limits here. Our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. Around $50 million needed for water infrastructure, Conroe City staff members say. City engineer Chris Bogert said around $50 million is needed to fund four water plants during a second discussion about the city's available water capacity at Conroe City Council's May 22nd workshop meeting. We've grossly underfed the infrastructure for years, and now we're at a crossroads here, Bogert said. The development's caught up. City staff held a second discussion with City Council about the city's available water capacity and the pace of development, during which Bogert and Public Works Director Norman McGuire expressed serious concerns about the city's water situation. We're going to have some aggressive funding going forward to get out of this, McGuire said. Chris was right. There's no immediate fix. This is a two-year problem, guaranteed 2 years. The discussion held at the May 22nd workshop meeting comes about a month after the first discussion of the city's water capacity during its April 24th workshop meeting. At that April 24th meeting, Bogert and McGuire expressed the same concerns about water capacity and the pace of development. During the May 22nd workshop meeting, Place 2 Council member Kurt Maddox asked staff if the city could dip into its fund balance, essentially a city savings account, to help fund water infrastructure. Colin Booth, the city's director of finance and assistant city administrator, said that could be an option, but that account must be drawn down carefully, otherwise it could affect the city's bond ratings. Place 3 council member Harry Hardman said the focus needs to be on what is critically needed within the next 2 years. We have to understand what is critical, and I say the next 24 months is critical, Hardman said. We have to address that with what we have. 36 months, we have to look at alternatives, maybe bond elections, whatever, but the can has been kicked as far as it's going to be kicked. And I like that turn of phrase. Bogert said McGuire is already getting calls regarding low water pressure. When it's 100 degrees during the week of May 27th, the calls are going to go up, Bogert said. And next year is going to be the hardest. Next summer is going to be the hardest. The irrigation in the summer is when we're hit the worst. Bogert also said after one well and one water plant came online in mid-June, the next water plant will not come online until around the summer of 2025. None of these are silver bullets, Bogert said. They all help, but we have a hard gap for about 16 months or 2 years until we get those other wells online. Meanwhile, budget discussions for fiscal year 24-25 should begin this summer. Now, as population grows and climate heats up, water is becoming a major problem everywhere, and we're not even in the driest part of the country. The Conroe City Council is trying to be responsive and responsible in managing development of water and sewer infrastructure, but in this story, it's admitted that, quote, the can has been kicked as far as it's going to be kicked. But it sounds to me like the can was kicked a little too far, and Conroe may now be facing a challenging 2+ years of tight supplies. To be fair, all democratically elected governments tend to do this. No one wants to make the hard decisions before they have to and get voted out of office. The result is that hard decisions are often made on the cusp of too late. Our next story is from thehill.com. Speaking of water and delaying the inevitable, water systems warn Americans could soon see major rate hikes to filter out toxic forever chemicals. In exchange for cleaner water, Americans around the nation may soon have to pay hefty prices. Water systems are starting to warn residents of massive rate hikes as they prepare to install technology to filter out toxic chemicals in a family known as PFAS. Utilities from South Florida to upstate New York have warned customers that they could see significant price increases after the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, mandated that they remove the substances which have been linked to a number of cancers and other diseases from their systems. Last month, the EPA said it will require utilities whose water systems contain high levels of 6 types of PFAS to remove them from the water. PFAS, which stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are a group of thousands of chemicals that have been used to make a variety of nonstick and waterproof products and firefighting foam. The substances have also become ubiquitous in the environment, due in part to the fact that they tend to persist for a long period of time instead of breaking down. Exposure to these so-called forever chemicals has been linked to increased risks of prostate, kidney, and testicular cancers, weakened immune systems, high cholesterol, and developmental issues in children. Now, for the first time, utilities around the nation will be required to get them out of their drinking water to prevent customers' exposure, but that will come at a price. Last month, officials with Broward County, a populous South Florida locale, warned residents that those on county water could see double or triple water rates for users. Fort Worth, Texas officials also warned of consequences for ratepayers ahead of the EPA setting the rule last month. It's going to be expensive, and it's going to impact our ratepayers, and we're going to be doing everything we possibly can to get some federal support in terms of the funding, but we're going to have to move forward, Fort Worth Water Director Chris Harder told Fort Worth Report. A lot of systems are going to be faced with having to increase rates as a result of the rule, said Chris Moody, regulatory technical manager of the American Water Works Association, a lobby group representing water providers. It's not entirely clear yet which water systems will need to filter out PFAS. The rule gives utilities a few years to test their water to determine if their levels of the chemicals fall above federal thresholds. If they do, utilities will then have to install technology to get rid of them. That means the locales that have informed their customers of rate increases may only be the first of many. The EPA, in its rule, estimated about 6-10% of water systems will ultimately be found to contain PFAS at levels requiring action. Moody said he believes this is an undercount and that more of the nation's water systems could be contaminated. Water providers recently settled a major class action lawsuit against manufacturers of PFAS, and chemical giants would have to collectively pay billions of dollars to offset treatment costs, but Moody said the settlements are not expected to be enough to defray the expense. If you do get money through it, it'll likely only help you with maybe a third or a fourth of the costs, he said. The added costs do come with the notable benefit of lowering communities' exposure to the harmful substances. Garcia described PFAS treatment as probably something important to do. We've talked about PFAS on this show before. They're serious carcinogens, and getting them out of our water is a good thing that will reduce illness and medical costs. But nothing is free, and very little is cheap. The class action settlements will defray the costs, but not cover them. I guess it could be argued that all of us have used and benefited from these chemicals, and will now be paying something like the true cost of them, but simply tripling everyone's water rates is not sustainable for our nation's poorest households. Some form of accommodation will have to be made for them. Our next story is from CommunityImpact.com. It's from May 16th, but I wasn't familiar with this bit of news, so you may not be either. The title is Whitmire on Transportation Pause. We will not sacrifice general mobility for recreation. In public comments made May 16th, Houston Mayor John Whitmire doubled down on an ongoing review his administration is conducting of planned transportation projects in the city that involve narrowing or reducing vehicle lanes. Whitmire, speaking to an audience gathered at a State of Mobility event hosted by Transportation Advocacy Group Houston, said the city will not sacrifice general mobility for recreation. Whitmire paused all transportation projects in March that would modify or change the use of vehicle lanes. Marlene Gaffrick, Houston's Director of Planning and Development, said the pause is intended to allow the administration time to review projects and decide which roads need to be redesigned. Going back to the transportation pause, we are doing things right, Whitmire said at the TAG event. We have to start doing projects that people will use across our region. Mobility is our number one priority. The pause has generated contention among Houstonians, including residents in the Heights and Montrose areas, who have spoken out against the pause and in favor of projects along 11th Street, Shepherd and Durham Drives, and Montrose Boulevard, among other streets. With some of the projects involving bicycle lanes or shared-use paths, cycling advocates have also taken issue with Whitmire's framing of the project as for recreational purposes, arguing that people should have options beyond cars for how to get around the city. The pause was first made public when Whitmire tasked the Houston Public Works Department with evaluating the effectiveness and impact of the 11th Street Bikeway project. That project was carried out as a way to improve safety and reduce speeds along 11th Street, which planners said was prone to a high number of crashes as well as speeding vehicles. The Texas chapter of the American Public Works Association dubbed the 11th Street redesign as the 2024 in-house project of the year in an announcement in early March. Aaron Jones, public information officer for Houston Public Works, said Whitmire is trying to get a first-hand view of all City of Houston departments and the significant projects, programs, and initiatives, a list that includes transportation and mobility. Abby Kamen, Houston City Council member for District C, which covers the Shepherd, Durham, 11th Street, and Montrose projects, said she requested a sit-down meeting with Whitmire to discuss the implications of redesigning the Shepherd-Durham corridor in particular, which she said the Memorial Heights Redevelopment Authority was tasked with doing last week. Kamen said that, quote, when council has unanimously voted on projects that have gone through community engagement, years of planning, and received overwhelming support, I'm concerned when there is an administrative decision to halt infrastructure-based safety and drainage projects, she said. We worked hard to get the federal dollars for Durham Shepherd. At a time when the city is under severe financial constraints, we should not be putting at risk dollars like this that bring much-needed improvements as well as an economic engine that will revitalize the corridor. Kamen said she has received 195 comments from residents in favor of the Shepherd-Durham project and only two who oppose. Whitmire said he has heard thousands of comments from residents who oppose the project. We have to be mindful of walkability, pedestrian crosswalks, bike paths, 10-foot sidewalks. I could go on about the issues, he said. Durham Shepherd keeps folks off Loop 610. It keeps them off I-45. It takes them down to Memorial, to the Medical Center, to the City of Houston. So let's all tell the rest of the story. As of May 16th, no timeline has been given regarding the length of the pause. Now, I had heard about the Whitmire-mandated pauses on Montrose, Shepherd, Durham, and 11th Street, but I had not heard Whitmire's explanation, and the rationale he expresses makes sense to me, saying the city will not sacrifice general mobility for recreation. I do use Durham and Shepherd, and I've driven the old four-lane blacktop and the new three-lane concrete. I think the four lanes of blacktop are best referred to as nominally four lanes. One or both of the edge lanes were so broken up that they were often avoided or used primarily as just turn lanes. The three lanes of concrete will probably allow better traffic flow in spite of the perception of traffic compression. Further, while I don't see a present need for 10-foot sidewalks, I certainly never liked the total absence of usable sidewalks on long stretches of these streets. I've been old long enough that the notion of commuting to a job by bike seems like an alien concept to me, but even when I was younger in a city like Houston, it mostly makes very little sense. Firstly, there are the distances. Unless someone has a job within a mile or two of where they live, biking to work seems impractical, and not just because of the distances. Sure, there are folks who can jog or bike for many, many miles, but that must work up a sweat, and that turns into body odor. Unless the workplace has facilities to wash up and change, it must surely impact coworkers and potential customers. Further, I'm not sure why it's essential to put protected bike lanes on roads that already have heavy motor vehicle traffic. And if we need bike lanes, and I'm not automatically opposed to them, whether for commuting or recreation, I'm puzzled as to why it doesn't make sense to put bike lanes on parallel routes that are already low in traffic. It seems to me that present bicycle traffic is low enough that it isn't unreasonable to put bikes on residential streets. Motor vehicles should already be doing maximum speeds of 20 to 30 miles at most on those streets, and this should work well with bike speeds of 10 to 20 miles per hour. These streets also tend to have frequent stop signs, which should make bike traffic safer for both cyclists and pedestrians. In terms of safety, this seems a far better option than trying to protect bike riders from congested motor vehicle lanes traveling at speeds of 35 to 45 miles per hour or more. If bicycle commuting should indeed become a much more heavily used option, we can address that metaphorical bridge when we come to it. As an aside, I keep suspecting that many bike lane advocates are drivers who hope that enough people will commute by bike to ease their vehicle traffic concerns. But the broader delay on infrastructure construction and the risks of losing federal and state dollars that are earmarked for it are bigger concerns. The road constructions that include improved drainage and flood control, burying of utilities, new water supply lines, etc., are absolutely essential. These improvements are necessary not only to replace old and overburdened infrastructure, but also to accommodate city growth for the present and the future, and to better prepare for climate change due to global warming. I hope that the Whitmire administration doesn't paint all projects with an overly broad brush. Sure, take a look at what's planned, but they mustn't let their notions of the perfect interfere with the long-negotiated good enough. Many, if not all, of these plans were hashed out through community input and engineering necessity over years. Everything in politics and civics is a compromise and should not be discarded lightly. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the landing page. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type in keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 80% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Hone. Again, look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Our next story is from HoustonPublicMedia.org. Houston area customers will cover CenterPoint's $100 million plus power restoration costs after deadly storm. Multiple electricity transmission towers toppled over in the Cypress, Texas area on Thursday, May 16th. A tornado touched down in the area, according to the National Weather Service. Houston area residents and businesses, hundreds of thousands of whom went without electricity in the days following last week's deadly windstorm, will end up having to cover the costs associated with turning their power back on. CenterPoint Energy, which supplies power to the Houston region, said Friday it expects its restoration costs to exceed $100 million. The company also said it plans to apply for interest-bearing securitization bonds to recover its storm-related costs, with that debt eventually being paid by its customers through monthly charges on their bills. Sandra Havarla, the president of the Texas Consumer Association, said it's common and understandable for utility companies to recover their expenses after weather-related disasters, adding that she wouldn't argue against the practice, but she said it's still unfair for customers who in many cases are still recovering themselves after last Thursday's derecho produced two tornadoes, damaged buildings and infrastructure, and led to at least eight deaths and knocked out electricity for about 922,000 customers, with CenterPoint having since restored power to all but a few thousand. CenterPoint said Thursday, and mind you, we had another storm after this article was actually written. CenterPoint said Thursday that its 7,000-plus employees and contractors had replaced more than 800 miles worth of electrical wires, along with 700 transformers and roughly 2,000 utility poles. The company said in a statement Friday afternoon, when more than 3,000 homes, businesses, and schools were without electricity, that its focus remains on continuing to work around the clock until every last customer can be restored that can receive service. The total restoration cost has not yet been determined, according to CenterPoint, which said it seeks to, it expects to seek approval from the Public Utility Commission of Texas, the PUCT, to apply for securitization bonds. The company has done that after previous severe weather events, such as Winter Storm Uri in 2021, when much of Texas faced prolonged freezing weather and extended power outages. Havrila said that there could be potentially more cost-effective options than securitization bonds, at least for electricity customers. Selling such bonds provides upfront money for CenterPoint, she said, but also comes with additional costs, such as interest and fees that will be factored into the related charges on customers' bills. Among the alternatives are adding direct surcharges to customers' bills or recovering the restoration costs through rate increase requests made through the PUCT, according to Havrila. CenterPoint in recent months applied to increase its electricity delivery rate to cover years' worth of capital investments it had made to bolster system resiliency and replace aging infrastructure. Havrila said the securitization route, or said of it, you're taking this amount that's already really large, that's going to get loaded onto CenterPoint customers, and then adding a bunch of costs on top of that. Energy costs already are a burden for many Houston area residents. A survey released in April by the nonprofit Texas Energy Poverty Research Institute said that 47% of people in the Gulf Coast region with low to moderate incomes consider their electricity bills to be unaffordable, a percentage that is significantly higher than the statewide average. So Havrila said she hopes CenterPoint and the State Utility Commission will be transparent about the restoration costs, as well as the financial implications for both the company and its customers. Either way, CenterPoint is going to recover that money, she said. At this point, it's a matter of how are they going to bill customers for the money and how that'll work out. I'm no expert on this stuff, but let's talk about the arguments here. Sandra Havrila is certainly correct about one thing. CenterPoint should and will recover its money somehow, whether through a securitization bond or rate increases or surcharges, or maybe some mixture. CenterPoint says that power restoration will cost something in the neighborhood of $100 million. Is that paid from cash they had on hand, or did they have to borrow that money to do those repairs? If it's borrowed, then CenterPoint will have to pay interest on that loan until it's paid back. A secured bond will put that cash immediately back in hand, and they'll pay off the loan. The bond fees and interest will subsequently be borne by their customers. On the other hand, if CenterPoint recovers those costs through rate increases or bill surcharges, their initial loan will be paid in installments, like any loan, accruing charges until it's paid off. Ultimately, their customers will pay those costs as well. A difference here, though, is what might be called opportunity cost. If their cash outlay is paid back in a trickle, they lose the opportunity to use that cash in other ways until they have it paid back. With the secured bond, CenterPoint gets the cash back in a lump or pays their debt in a lump. If they have an outstanding debt, that debt is an overhang on their balance sheets, meaning that borrowing more money for a need or an opportunity will be even more costly, since existing debt creates higher risk for the lender. None of this is defense of how CenterPoint wants to recover their costs. I'm just trying to show that there is complexity in the calculations. There may be a way for CenterPoint to recover expenses that are optimal for both the company and their customers. Sandra Havrila's point is well taken. This question needs to be examined before CenterPoint makes a decision. Our next story is from ABC30.com. A passenger on United flight to Fresno had measles, officials confirm. A passenger on a flight to Fresno is confirmed to be traveling with measles, according to L.A. County health officials. The traveler was on United Flight 5591, which left Los Angeles at 8 p.m. Sunday, May 19th, and landed in Fresno at 9 p.m. Their passenger, who had measles, initially started their trip in Munich, Germany, and connected at LAX. Anyone who is assigned seats near that passenger on the flights will be notified by health officials. Measles is a highly contagious airborne disease that can cause severe sickness, especially in young children, I might also add that it exists on surfaces for some period of time. The viral infection spreads easily through the air when an infected person breathes, talks, coughs, or sneezes. Measles symptoms don't appear until 10 to 14 days after exposure. They include cough, runny nose, inflamed eyes, sore throat, fever, and a red, blotchy skin rash. Measles is easily preventable via vaccine. Health officials encourage everyone to confirm their measles vaccination status with their health care provider. Now, this isn't technically a local story, but I'll point out several things that are not included in this story. First, since the person began their trip in Munich, Germany, it's not automatically safe to assume that this person was a U.S. citizen or even a German citizen. The story simply doesn't say. Second, the story makes no mention of whether this person claimed to have been previously vaccinated. And even if they were, vaccines are not 100% effective. Third, the story doesn't say if this person had any reason to suspect they had been exposed to measles, or if any symptoms had occurred sooner and might have been spotted sooner, no pun intended. I'll also point out that if this person had reason to suspect exposure to measles, they wouldn't be the first to avoid canceling travel plans and crossing their fingers that they wouldn't get sick. What this story does suggest to me is that in an era of vaccine deniers, it might not be unreasonable to consider rules requiring a vaccination record of some sort on file at a central facility that would be checked whenever someone is applying to travel on a common carrier. This would simply be part of checking someone's ID before buying a ticket. This is something that really should be considered as part of providing for the common good. If your freedom should end at the tip of my nose, I sure don't want your nasty viruses entering my nose when I can't otherwise avoid you. Our next story is from BusinessInsider.com. It's called, Hey America, Here's What's Actually Going On with the Economy. America, we totally understand if you're not feeling so great about the economy, but if you think we're in a recession, here's some good news. We're not in one, and there likely isn't one coming based on economic data and what experts who talk to Business Insider are seeing. A Harris poll for The Guardian found 56% of Americans believe the U.S. is in a recession. Plus, it found a majority think we have a shrinking economy. Two reasons people may be feeling like the economy isn't doing so well, despite the U.S. not being in an official recession since the two-month one in early 2020, are due to media coverage and how people view economic trends. David Kelly, chief global strategist at J.P. Morgan Asset Management, Eugenio Alemán, Raymond Jones chief economist, and Gregory Dako, EY's chief economist, told Business Insider the U.S. is not in a recession. Americans' negative attitude towards the economy is largely due to incessantly negative media coverage of economic and social issues, amplified by an even more negative social media feed, Kelly told Business Insider in a statement. And I'll mention, it's funny that someone from J.P. Morgan would say these kinds of things, because J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon is consistently bearish and talking down the economy. Irony. But moving on. The story continues. Of course, not everything is perfect, and that could sour people's views. Dako said that when you consider cost fugue, inflation's cumulative effect, the largely frozen and unaffordable housing market, and also the reduced amount of churn in the labor market, and this perception that there are fewer opportunities out there in terms of jobs, then that leads to more pessimism about the implied state of the economy. U.S. GDP is still growing. Kelly listed growth and expected growth in quarterly GDP as one of the most important numbers to watch in addition to payroll gains, which recently cooled but are still signaling a strong labor market, and the weekly unemployment insurance claims, which have been low as large-scale layoffs have not yet emerged. Real GDP, gross domestic product, for the U.S. has continued to be robust even if growth has been slowing. Unemployment rates in the U.S. have been low. The unemployment rate did climb from 3.8% in March to 3.9% in April, but that's still low, and I'll add that's historically low. In the Great Recession, the U.S. unemployment rate skyrocketed from 5% in December 2007 to 9.5% in June 2009. It took years for the job market to fully recover after that recession, while unemployment plummeted after the brief but deep COVID recession in 2020. CPI data shows U.S. inflation is stubborn, but has been under 4%, and that's the Consumer Price Index. Inflation is still elevated and stubborn, but the year-over-year change in the Consumer Price Index has cooled from the high 2021 and 22 rates. Al-Aman said while inflation is comparatively low, the surge in inflation since 2021 has pushed Americans to try to figure out what to buy and what not to buy, something that we were not used to doing before. The S&P 500 has generally been rising for over a year. In 2024, the S&P 500 hit multiple all-time highs. The Harris poll for The Guardian found nearly half thought the S&P 500 index had actually been down. There isn't a recession in the U.S. now, or one coming soon, either. If you're worried about a recession coming soon, you may feel better knowing that experts don't think so. Al-Aman and Raymond James don't foresee one, but expect a slowdown in economic activity. Looking at the next 12 months, Dayco said recession odds are relatively low. Kelly said the U.S. isn't even close to a recession. There are still some data points and trends that Americans may be concerned about. Sales for existing homes and new homes dropped recently. While mortgage rates are back below 7%, they're still elevated. Layoffs are happening at some major companies. Inflation is still not back to the Fed's 2% target, and it still looks like interest rates are still going to be high for a while, although probably not going up, in my opinion. So, hooray for no recession, and likely no recession anytime soon. However, just because we aren't in a recession doesn't mean the economy is perfect. Now, in my opinion, this is another example of the news you consume determining the worldview you have, and not necessarily vice versa. I can't tell you where to get your information, though if you ask, I will. But what I can tell you is that diversity of sources and perspectives makes a difference. We all have biases in our perspectives, and I'm certainly no exception. What I try to do is base my views on the world on a preponderance of the evidence. I guess I'm borrowing that term from civil law, which I take to mean more likely than not. I start with the following news sources, or rather with following news sources that I feel I can trust. In my case, I've had over 50 years of news consumption to shape that view. But if you're starting from what I might call a naive base point, you'll have to exert more effort. One way to begin might be to search the term news bias rankings. A number of possible sources will pop up, and you can begin there. After scanning several of these sources, certain trends will likely appear among them as to which left, right, or center, and how far at the extremes. My advice is that whatever your bias inclination might be, avoid the extremes in either direction. There's an expression, the truth is paywalled, but the lies are free. I would love it if there was a group subscription model like there is in the music industry for business consumers. Pay a certain amount per month or per year, and you can subscribe to news media for anywhere from a few articles per month to unlimited, but that's not the world we live in. There are good sources of reasonably factual news that generally have no paywalls. Some are public services like PBS, BBC, the Australian Broadcast Corporation known as ABC down under, the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and a good rule of thumb might be publicly sponsored news sources from what you might call small-l liberal democracies. Associated Press and Reuters get generally, or I could edit that out, but I think it's funny. It's not Reuters, it's Reuters. It's actually originally a Germanic name. Reuters. Associated Press and Reuters get generally high marks. The Guardian from the UK is not paywalled. They do ask for donations, but they are for profit. My experience is that news organizations from U.S. companies like ABC, CBS, and NBC are generally good news sources. I avoid Fox News except for stories where they have no political axe to grind, such as science and some business stories and maybe sports stories, specific companies or industry trends. There are certainly others I haven't mentioned, but these are a good start. Some paywalled services do allow you a certain number of free articles per month if you establish a login and provide an email address. Those sites usually offer 3 to 5 free articles per month. I would love to provide links, but at the time of this writing, my internet has been down. But fortunately, my word processor isn't cloud-based, but I do hope all this information helps. I have included a link to an Atlantic.com article called Democracy Dies Behind Paywalls. You may have to either subscribe or give them your email and login in order to read that. But let me know what you think. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org. You can hear previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick Think Wing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. The next story is from APnews.com. Republican-appointed University of Wisconsin regent refuses to step down when term ends. A conservative University of Wisconsin regent says he won't step down when his term ends this month. Then-Governor Scott Walker, a Republican, appointed Robert Atwell to the Board of Regents in May of 2017. His 7-year term ends this month. Atwell sent an email to Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman, Regents President Karen Walsh, and Regents Executive Director Megan Wassley on Monday, saying he won't step down until he chooses to resign or the state Senate confirms a successor. The state Supreme Court ruled in 2022 that political appointees don't have to leave their posts until the Senate confirms their successor. Atwell said in his email that Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss reminded him that he could remain in his position on the Regents. Democratic Governor Tony Evers has yet to announce Atwell's successor. Atwell said he hoped that his temporary continuation as regent will support communication between legislators and the Regents. In one email, one of Atwell's complaints was that no one has ever answered his questions about how many faculty and staff quit or were fired because they defied the system's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Atwell is one of two Walker-appointed regents who remain on the board. The other is Chris Peterson. Her term expires in May of 2025. I just have a short comment here. This article reminds us that Republicans often don't like to give up power until they are forced to. Buyer beware. From TheGuardian.com, President warns new Army officers to be guardians of American democracy. President entreats graduates at commencement to hold fast to oath to U.S. Constitution in veiled reference to Trump's threat to democracy. Joe Biden has called newly graduating U.S. military officers the guardians of American democracy at a commencement speech at the elite West Point Military Academy in New York State, where the U.S. president, without mentioning Donald Trump by name, gave strong warnings of unprecedented threats to U.S. freedom. Biden, speaking in front of about 1,000 graduating cadets at the U.S. Army Training Academy on Saturday, urged the newly minted officers to hold fast to their military oath, quote, not to a political party, not to a president, but to the Constitution of the United States of America, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. In remarks that could be seen as a thinly veiled reference to the threat to democracy Biden believes Trump poses to the U.S. as the two candidates battle for the White House in November's election, the president said that the oath taken by the military is as important to your nation now as it ever has been. The president said the U.S. was founded on an idea of equality, but that ideas need defenders to make them real, and that's what you, the class of 2024, are all about. He went on to say the defenders of freedom, champions of liberty, guardians, and I mean this, guardians of American democracy, you must keep us free at this time like none before. It's the end of his quote. Biden outlined a global situation that he said had placed unprecedented challenges upon the U.S. military, warning that the cadets are graduating into a world like none before. He said there's never been a time in history when we've asked our military to do so many, many different things in so many different places around the world all at the same time. Biden said the NATO alliance was stronger than ever, praised the U.S. military for its efforts in erecting a pier and delivering airdrops to provide to Palestinians suffering amid Israel's war in Gaza, and said the U.S. was, quote, standing up for peace and stability, unquote, regarding the threat posed by China to Taiwan. Trump has seen some of his support from the military community erode. In 2016, he won 60% of voters who said at the time that they served in the military, according to exit polls conducted by NBC News. That figure dropped to 54% in 2020, according to NBC News. When I was reading this article, the speech by Biden would not usually be anything remarkable. Presidents say similar things to every West Point graduating class. What makes this one different and worth mentioning is the times we're living in and the special emphasis that Joe Biden put into his words. I feel I can hear that emphasis even in the text of his speech. What I hear him saying to this graduating class of Army officers is that they owe loyalty above all to no one and nothing except the U.S. Constitution, to which they have taken an oath. Our military people stood by the Constitution during the Trump era when it was sometimes made very hard for them to do so. I've read stories of generals being faced with decisions of who to obey and when, and whether orders were political or military, and what their oaths required them to do, and to parse language. We should never again put our military people in anything remotely like that position, no matter what level and rank they're at. That's what I hear Joe Biden saying to this cadet class. Now, I think he needs to emphasize the same thing to the Treasury Department and their Secret Service people. There have been questions over the past few years over whether the Secret Service protective details feel that their final allegiance is to the people they're assigned to protect or to their constitutional oaths. There have been too many scenarios that have come to light where there seems to be some ambiguity in the minds of some agents. Let's be clear. Biden should be clear. There should be none. And if a president loses an election, there should be no questions as to whether the soon-to-be ex-president's Secret Service detail will defend the loser's determination to stay in power, or whether the ex-president's Secret Service detail will assist in escorting that person out. Now from TheHill.com, Kevin O'Leary's dystopian fantasy of ruining the lives of campus protesters, written by a civil lawyer. Canadian business mogul Kevin O'Leary has a new favorite hobby: threatening college students with the destruction of their livelihoods forever if they're caught at pro-Palestine protests. The Shark Tank judge says he will use omnipresent 1080p and 4K surveillance cameras capable of retinal scanning, whose footage will be analyzed by AI protocols and made readily available to employers through background checks on the deep web and the dark web. "I know who you are," O'Leary says. For the rest of their lives, the protesters, quote, won't know why they didn't get that job, he says. I won't be hiring any of them. When asked whether it's fair for a single act to hang over someone's head for the rest of their life, his answer, life is hard. Then you die. I'm sure he's in a position to know. Going on, Gen Z is already suffering from a mental health crisis thanks to and by big tech. The last thing they need are villains like O'Leary giving them nightmares about how they'll be haunted forever by some Orwellian regime of techno-fascist corporate blacklisting. Much of what O'Leary has been saying about the present power of facial recognition technology and dark web background checks sounds like he got it from those scenes in action movies where someone says, "Enhance!" First, laws already exist to protect Americans from the type of oppressive hiring practices O'Leary is promoting. It sure sounds like he's been breaking some. For instance, under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, or FRCA, an employer can't reject a job applicant based on a third-party background check without giving the applicant a copy of the report so he or she can dispute its accuracy and completeness with the company that created it. And if the job salary is below $75,000, the FCRA prohibits a background check company's report from including any negative information that is over 7 years old, except for records of criminal convictions. There are also some state and local laws that stop employers from holding applicants' politics against them. Second, the extraordinary cruelty of O'Leary's position, the injustice of which he seems to embrace, should spur an urgent public push for even stronger laws against such schemes. For a huge swath of Americans, the constitutional right to free speech is useless without privacy laws that free their speech from employers' surveillance. A 2016 Pew survey found that Americans try to hide their online behavior from their employer's supervisor and coworkers over twice as often as they try to hide it from the government. What does that say about what's really constraining American speech these days? We do, at least try, in my words, to separate church and state to stop them from interfering with each other. It's time to do the same with the job market and to the marketplace of ideas. America already has legal and policy frameworks for new Stop Kevin O'Leary laws to build on. The FCRA starts by stating, quote, "There is a need to ensure that consumer reporting agencies exercise their grave responsibilities with fairness, impartiality, and a respect for the consumer's right to privacy," unquote. For that exact reason, the FCRA should be amended to further restrict background checks disclosures of job seekers' political activities. We could start by simply raising the $75,000 salary limit so that Dirk gets scrubbed from more background checks after 7 years. New reforms can also draw inspiration from ban-the-box laws that several states and municipalities have enacted to curtail an employer's consideration of an applicant's criminal history. Those laws embody a strong public policy in favor of second chances and fresh starts. Most Americans would likely agree that similar legal protections should be afforded to those with a history of nonviolent protest. There is nothing uniquely odious about pro-Palestine protesters that would warrant their uniquely permanent banishment from the workplace. First, let me say that I've never liked Kevin O'Leary. Any time I've dropped in on Shark Tank while I'm surfing channels, I'm always struck by how eager he is to take maximum advantage of people pitching their ideas on the show. He has seemed to me to be a cruel, greedy man. I might describe him as Ebenezer Scrooge, but with better grooming. This story about him really just reinforces that feeling. Would calling O'Leary evil be going too far? I'm not sure. In any case, I think that Attorney Weiss's suggestion for Stop Kevin O'Leary laws is an excellent idea, and maybe we should name them that. We all do things we regret, except maybe Kevin O'Leary, or may not. But if, for example, we break the law and then pay our debt to society, should punishment extend outside of the law to the rest of our lives? That may often be how it seems, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do better as a society. From BBC.com, Tory conservatives want to bring back compulsory national service. 12 months of mandatory national service would be reintroduced by the conservatives if they win the general election. 18-year-olds would be able to apply for one of 30,000 full-time military placements or volunteering 1 weekend a month carrying out a community service. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said he believed bringing back compulsory service across the UK would help foster the national spirit that emerged during the pandemic. Labour criticized the plans, expected to cost about $2.5 billion, as desperate and unfunded. The Conservatives want the first teenagers to take part in a pilot from September 2025, with details to be worked out by a royal commission. The armed forces placements would allow young people to learn about cybersecurity, logistics, procurement, or civil response operations. Non-military volunteering would involve 25 days with organizations such as the fire service, the police, and the NHS. Mr. Sunak said, quote, "This is a great country, but generations of young people have not had the opportunities or experience they deserve, and there are forces trying to divide our society in this increasingly uncertain world." He went on, "I will bring in a new model of national service to create a shared sense of purpose among our young people and a renewed sense of pride in our country." Unquote. He added the move would help young people to learn real-world skills, do new things, and contribute to their community and our country. The Conservatives said the move would help ensure young people who were not employed, in education or training, or at risk of getting involved with crime would be diverted away from, quote, lives of unemployment and crime. They were unable to say what sanctions those not taking part could face. Instead, they argued national service would provide valuable work experience and ignite a passion for a future career in health care, public service, charity, or the armed forces. The party said the £2.5 billion cost of national service would see £1.5 billion diverted from levelling up UK's Shared Prosperity Fund from 2028. A further £1 billion would come from plans to crack down on tax avoidance and evasion. A Labour Party spokesman said former Prime Minister David Cameron had outlined a similar idea with his Big Society in 2010. I observe that the story then diverts into comments from Labour that the Tories hollowed out the military and that's why they need this program, but I note they still don't disagree with it in principle. Continuing, military conscription has never applied in Northern Ireland, and so far there are no details about what would happen there. National service was introduced in 1947 after World War II by Clement Attlee's Labour government. It meant men between the ages of 17 and 21 had to serve in the armed forces for 18 months. The mandatory national service scheme came to an end in 1960. Earlier this year, the chief of the general staff, Sir Patrick Sanders, suggested that UK might need a citizen army to fight Putin, but his concerns were dismissed by Mr. Sunak's team at the time as, quote, not helpful. A number of European countries, including Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, already have a form of conscription for their armed forces. Conscription requires young men and women to serve for a limited time in uniform. It means that some of the population will have had some military training and can then be assigned to reserve units should war break out. Cuts in the British Army have seen its size fall from more than 100,000 in 2010 to around 73,000 as of January 2024. While this article is about the United Kingdom, I agree with it, and I've been saying as much on the radio since 2010. A country needs a professional army at its core for contingencies, but in the event of a national emergency, that central corps of professionals will not only be the nation's first responders, they'll also be the trainers for all the citizen soldiers who follow. I also agree with the basic outline of offering the option of 12 months of military training, which is essentially basic physical weapons equipment and other training. I also agree and have myself proposed a public service option that would be non-military in nature, but would have the benefit of both teaching skills to trainees as well as benefiting from their labor for the social and national good. But one of the reasons I've been a strong proponent of a similar scheme here is that I think it's good for the citizenry as part of their basic education, either after high school or after college, and I think it would have the effect of closing divides in this country. I believe that since the draft ended, we lost one key benefit of even a peacetime army, the opportunity for people from all walks of life to meet and get to know other Americans from other walks of life. I think most people would find that the strangers that had been vilified in the small, closed social circles they came from were maybe not as bad as they were led to believe, and they might even make some friends. There would also be opportunities for participants to see what other parts of the country are like, whether it be cities, small towns, colonias, Indian reservations, poor neighborhoods, or richer neighborhoods. I do believe that there are useful skills that trainees could learn that will help them advance in their lives. I also feel that on balance, instituting some form of universal national service would be enormously beneficial for this country, not just for its national defense, but also for its social and political cohesion. I'm including a reference article below this blog that gives details on how the proposed British plan might work. I strongly suggest clicking through and reading it. It sounds very reasonable and plausible. Last week I read the first part of an opinion piece called Confronting Another Axis, History, Humility, and Wishful Thinking by Philip Zelikow. Philip Zelikow is an attorney and former career diplomat. His federal service includes work across five administrations from Reagan through Obama, among other qualifications. This week I'll be reading part two. To recap, drawing on his extensive experience as a historian and diplomat, Philip Zelikow warns that the United States faces an exceptionally volatile time in global politics and that the period of maximum danger might be in the next 1 to 3 years. He highlights lessons from the anti-American partnerships developed by the Axis powers in World War II and by Moscow in Beijing during the early Cold War. Zelikow reminds decision-makers who face Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea today to remember that adversaries can miscalculate and recalculate, and that it can be difficult to fully understand internal divisions within an adversary's government, how rival states draw their own lessons from different interpretations of history, and how they might quickly react to a new event that appears to shift power dynamics. The United States faces a purposeful set of powerful adversaries in a rapidly changing and militarized period of history short of all-out war. This is the third time the United States has been confronted with such a situation. The first was between 1937 and 1941 and was resolved by American entry into World War II. The second was between 1948 and 1962, implicating the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. Thankfully, World War was avoided, and in November of 1962, the Soviet Union relaxed its stance in the Central Confrontation in Europe. It is not yet clear when and how the present-day crisis will resolve. We are in an exceptionally volatile, dynamic, and unstable period of world history. During the next 2 or 3 years, the situation will probably settle more durably in one direction or another, wider war or uneasy peace. There is a serious possibility of worldwide warfare because of the variety of contingencies and outcomes, some involving nuclear arsenals. This period could be more difficult to gauge and more dangerous for the United States than the prior two episodes. Zelikow trains a historian's microscope on some of the inner deliberations in past episodes. Now, last week we left off part one, having discussed how close NATO and the USSR came to confrontation over Yugoslavia in 1951. We now continue with part two. In 1951, as the U.S. government looked around at other dangers beyond Korea, there was only one main vector for possible enemy escalation. It was in Europe. In 2024, the situation is more complicated. Today, Zelikow's measure of serious possibility is more Nitz's lower probability than Kent's more pessimistic guess. In February of 2021, a year before it happened, Zelikow would have placed no higher odds than Nitz's in favor of a comprehensive Russian invasion of Ukraine, an invasion that would follow the public announcement of a Chinese-Russian partnership, quote, without limits. We can all reflect on what we misjudged back in early 2021. Today, the United States has to examine at least four main vectors for enemy escalation. These could involve Russia, China, Iran, including Israel, and North Korea on their own or linked in some way, ties that sometimes bind. Speaking to Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow in 2023, China's top diplomat Wang Yi said, quote, crisis and chaos appear repeatedly before us, but within crisis there is opportunity. Now, I thought that was interesting, and I'll note here that I have heard over the years that the Chinese character for crisis is a combination of the characters for danger and opportunity. If that is true, there could be a cultural and linguistic factor in shaping Wang's view of the situation. But continuing, all three of the major anti-American partnerships during the last 100 years were founded on a common core. In each case, the partners believed that the United States is the leader or anchor of a domineering imperial or neo-imperial system. They believe this hegemonic system strains in every way to block or strangle their nation's aspirations. They rally others who also feel oppressed to their cause. That is the core. Beyond that core, though, the partnerships may not have any master plan or planners. Historically, the partners rarely trusted each other. They often do not even like each other. Historical analogies are only useful for suggesting what is possible, not what is probable. Recalling this history of past anti-American partnerships illustrates opportunism, constant strategic calculation and recalculation, divided councils, and the potential for quick, dramatic changes. The American view of the history draws a clear separation between the Axis powers of the 1930s and 40s and the Communist bloc during the High Cold War, yet U.S. adversaries see these conflicts differently. From their point of view, these sets of struggles had a lot of continuity. To them, in both cases, strange bedfellows got together to resist domineering imperialists, to achieve true independence, and to gain control of, or at least a rightful share in running, the reigning world order. The anti-imperialists, the anti-hegemonists, all focus on America as the anchor and symbol of what they resent, the supposed confinement, power wrapped in pieties, opposing national assertion by new great powers. Like the old anti-hegemonists, all glorify war and sacrifice in their public culture. The anti-American leaders like Putin and Xi do not have as much personal experience of war and violence as leaders like Adolf Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, or Benito Mussolini did, though there are some exceptions in Iran. The new generation of anti-American leaders are feeling their way. They are wondering if it is their historical mission to usher in a new age of what they think of as necessary violence. We in America, for our part, are trying to keep such a new age at bay. That's all we have time for now. Part 3 next week. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We're Houston's community media. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. You all take care.
And find the place that's safe and warm. It's not too late.
A big thank you to our members who make the music, news, and talk at KPFT possible. During times like these, music helps us deal with the news. And there's a lot of news to deal with. One way to help us bring your KPFT's lineup of music and news is to donate a vehicle you no longer need. We'll pick it up, get top dollar for it, and invest the funds right back into bringing you the KPFT programming you rely on. Get started at kpft.org or call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. That's 1-855-KPFT-CAR.
Life in Houston is filled with options. You could do something different every night for a year and never run out of music, theater, films, or restaurants. How to decide? We can help. KPFT is a rich resource for community, culture, and cuisine. Son Pacifica keeps you current on the latest Latino films, theater, restaurants, and books. Howl in the Blues connects you to the city's live music scene, and our weekly Living Art broadcast features local artists and events you might not discover otherwise. These are just a few of the many programs that will help you make the most of your city, even on nights when you're staying in. And small donations from listeners like you make it all possible. Become a member today. Call us or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org and hit the donate button. We're Houston's community.